gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on irishradio.com and on nyuirish.net/radiohour. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. History and Irish Studies here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. It's a nice time to sit down and have a chat to Joe as the semester winds down and as we come into the closing weeks and days of 2014. It's been a special year for the New York GAA, so I wanted to have a sit down and chat to Joe about the role of the GAA in the diaspora for Irish immigrants abroad and just how the history of the GAA has evolved over time. So I hope you'll enjoy that chat. During this week's show as well, I want to recite a couple of poems that I thought were appropriate for this time of year. They're both by Brendan Kennelly, a well-known Irish poet. One is called This December Day, and the other is called The Wren Boy. Yesterday, December 26th, St. Stephen's Day, many of you will know, is a famous day for the Wren tradition in Ireland, where people dress up and go around, not too dissimilar from what they do at Halloween, an old Irish custom that is thankfully still done in many parts of the country. Still, my own cousins in West Cork often are Wren boys. So I hope you'll enjoy Brendan Kennelly's take on that. And I thought this December day was an appropriate poem for this week's show as well. It's an incredible honour for me to sit down and talk to someone who is the boss around here, Professor John Joseph Lee, Joe, as he's known by most of us around here. It's Joe's first time on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, at least in terms of a sit-down interview. And I wanted to take the opportunity, given that we're coming towards the end of 2014 and we are reflecting back on the GAA as an organization officially here in New York since 1914. And I would like to remind people that Gaelic games were played obviously prior to 1914. For any of you who don't know, the GAA in New York City actually organizationally grew out of what is now known as the United Irish Counties Association, and there was a very symbiotic relationship, and indeed the counties organizations, many of you will be familiar with them because they're still in operation today, and the umbrella body, which is now known as the United Irish Counties Association, was actually the organization, and the individuals involved in that were the people who really founded the GAA as we know it today here in New York in 1914. But I suppose we'll start off, Joe, by getting a sense from your perspective on your work on the Irish diaspora as to generally the role of the GAA in terms of, I suppose, the migrant community, the first generation, those coming from Ireland and beyond that. Could you give me an overview of your sense of the importance of the organisation?
Well, I think the GAA was one of the great bonding organisations among Irish immigrants from the late 19th century. After all, it was founded in Ireland in 1884. Now, its early growth, I mean, is contested and is slow enough, and there are a lot of changes of rules and regulations and who represents where and that sort of thing. A lot of, I would have to say, internal differences of opinion, let's put it like that, but worked out gradually over time for all the differences. So by the turn of the century, it was a strong organisation, but not growing at a pell-mell rate by any means. And it was really, I suppose, in the second and third decades of the 20th century at home in Ireland before it began to acquire the stability of purpose, the stability of base that allowed it to become the really quite extraordinary organisation it has been ever since. Now, it was fighting against quite a lot of odds in many ways. You'd have to say that, of course, in Europe as a whole at that time, and particularly in Britain, which was the pioneer in many ways of mass public sport, which is natural enough because that's coming out of the Industrial Revolution. One is trying to find something to provide alternatives to just non-stop work, to provide entertainment for a rapidly urbanising population, which is what Britain was, and with reductions in the length of the working week, which, remember, had been sort of 60 hours a week in factory work and so on, into the late 19th century. Now, Ireland was very unusual in the sense that the GAA grew up predominantly in rural Ireland. I would say probably as an organisation, it's remarkable for many reasons, but it grows up in rural Ireland, in small town, and it's particularly in village Ireland, in parish Ireland. And indeed, today, you know, the counties play one another in the All-Ireland Championships and things like that. In the early days, it was the champion club team, which meant a parish team usually, within the county, mm-hmm. that represented the county. So the roots go from the pride in the little village, so to speak, gradually spreading out beyond that into the county as a whole. And then even for a while into the provinces, because you had the Railway Cup for many years, which has declined a lot since, or in fact, really vanished, I think. So the counties become the representatives of a wider sense of who am I? You know, you might guess I'm a Kerry man, etc., because that's where one is born. But the counties become the conduits of the pride in the little village, even though you could have fierce, fierce battles between villages and parishes within the counties. But they came together over time, and there are still battles, of course, in selecting the county teams, you know, who will get on from which parish team. Nevertheless, I think the GAA, it derives its longevity, it derives the intensity of loyalty, remembering above all that it's an amateur organisation. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many extraordinary professional organisations in different sports around the world. And if you look in this country, if you look at the national football, you look at the football, you look at the baseball, you look at the basketball, they're highly professional. There's a pile of money in those things, right? What has been at the core of the GAA and what has given it, I think, virtually its unique standing in terms of a sense of national identity is that it's an amateur organisation. Obviously, some money has to come in because in today's world you can't operate on the basis simply of the simplicities of a century ago. But it's a truly extraordinary organisation. And I had an example of that. I'm deviating a bit now. It's a good story, I think. It's an illustrative story. About 20 years ago, I happened to be a member of the Cultural Committee, I think, Cultural and Sporting Committee of the Irish Senate. And there was a parallel English body, an English grouping. This was during the ceasefires and so on in the north. And the English crowd, anyway, came across once protesting strongly about the exclusion of the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, from membership of the GAA in Northern Ireland. Now, there was a conflict going on. You can imagine RUC chaps sitting down there with people who would have included IRA sympathisers, to put it mildly, what that would have caused. And the GAA was opposing that. And so these people came to Dublin demanding to see the directors, the heads of the GAA, through our committee. And we brought them up to Croke Park. And it was actually very instructive, Miriam, as to how one handled these very earnest, very genuine, very well-meaning, and totally ignorant people. And so we brought them in. When I say we, a key figure in the GAA at that time was Danny Lynch from Dingle. And the president was Jack Boodman, who, thanks be to God, as things turned out, was the first Protestant to be president of the GAA since God knows when, if ever, I think. I think it was the first. But they brought him in, from you know Croke Park, they brought him in the Hogan Stand side, walked across the centre of the field, towards the Cusick Stand, the new Cusick Stand, which is a magnificent edifice. And I was walking with a chap, Sir Giles, I called him. It was a lovely fellow, but I could see his eyes widening as we walked across. He had thought of the GAA as some sort of peasant outfit, I think, you know. Village roughs, I suppose. And halfway across, he said suddenly to me, "This place is bigger than Twickers." Now, Twickers is Twickenham, the headquarters of British rugby. And in his idea, you know, these peasants were going to be sort of way off in the margins. And he couldn't believe it. And then he said, "How is it quoted on the stock exchange?" And I said, "Giles," I said, "this is an amateur organisation." Well, the eyes fell out of his head. And it suddenly dawned on me, he was for the first time realising the administrative ability and also the political ability, the organisational capacity behind the GAA. And by the time we reached the Cusick Stand, I could see he was already backing away from demanding of these people that they do something that the British wanted. Because he'd come to the conclusion, these people must know how to run themselves. They couldn't have this mm-hmm. if it weren't for innate administrative capacity. And then it was wonderful when we actually met Jack Boodman and Danny Lynch in their office. What the British wanted, as I say, was that the RUC should be allowed to, you know, join the GAA presumably sitting on GAA councils in Northern Ireland. And at that time, the I think it was Cross McGlynn were the county champions of Armagh, football champions, and I think of Ireland. And the British had commandeered their pitch as a helicopter base. So what Boothman and Denny had done, they had a picture, they had film of the helicopters rising above the wall of Cross McGlynn Field. And they explained patiently to the British, well, of course, we too would wish for conciliation and we would wish to have an All-Ireland organisation, but you will understand there are hard feelings up there. Very hard feelings. And then a helicopter would just suddenly shoot up above the wall, you see, and the boys would be looking at this and you could see them saying, what do we let ourselves in for here, basically? And then Jack says, well, of course, in principle, we would like that too, but in our rules, you need a 60%, I think it was 60% majority, maybe it's 2/3 majority, to allow new members in like that. And we think we'd have over 50%, but we don't think we'd have the 60%. And in our rules, you can only debate these things once every 3 years. And it would be very bad if it were to be lost when it came in. We don't feel we should bring it in until we're certain it has the support of 2/3, because that would then be a way forward towards peace, reconciliation, and all these wonderful things that we all talked about. And by the end, the British were arguing, no, under no circumstances must you introduce it until you're certain it's going to win. We can see your difficulty. Of course we can. And we can go back and explain that. They'll understand in London. Wow. Right? So it was, to me, it was a wonderful exhibition of both, you know, the genuine achievement of the GAA in stadium terms and this sort of thing, but also their skill. And really, they were playing these guys who were professional politicians. Mm-hmm. They were playing them like you play a fish and getting them to actually expound the GAA doctrine back to their friends in London. So there's a lot gone into that. There's 100 years of skill in dealing with difficult situations mm-hmm. gone into that, as well as everything about the game itself.
Mm-hmm. What has struck me in recent years, Joe, about the organisation is, say, when I arrived in New York about 8 years ago, you know, with the Celtic Tiger, with a, sure. you know, full throttled, I mean, we didn't know it was coming towards the end at the time. But, you know, there weren't that many young players here. There wasn't a lot of immigration to the United States. I saw in the Irish community in London, the GAA there was probably in a better shape just because of the sheer numbers of Irish continually going to places like England. What seems to have evolved in recent years here is with the young professionals coming over mm-hmm. who are here working on Wall Street or mm-hmm. working as lawyers and things like that. They have revived or they have established this new GAA club here in New York, the Manhattan Gaels. I don't know whether mm-hmm. you're familiar with it. But what just strikes me about that is how this organization seems to have a capacity of reinventing itself. And it seems to be doing that in other parts, you know, in places like Australia or Canada where there are young Irish going. Does that speak to some of the things you've just touched on in terms of, I don't know, the roots of it or the history of it in terms of what people have brought with them from Ireland?
I think it does, because I think we underrate, if you like, the distinctive qualities of Irish society, which some people would describe as backward. But in fact, if they're properly used, and I mean sort of the great pride in place, the pride in your local place, and it goes from village, the parish to county, there is still, I think, fierce county pride in Ireland. And that, of course, could historically have expressed itself in pitched battles between people from different counties and so on, in rivalries that would not be commendable today. But a lot of that pride has been, I think, translated, actually, into sport, into GAA activity. And it can often be dormant if the county isn't doing well in the All-Ireland Championship, that sort of thing. But you can see when counties suddenly rise. Mm-hmm. It happens from time to time, not as often as I would like to see it happening, because there is a, I won't say a stranglehold, but there is a continuity of command by a relatively small number of counties in both football and hurling. And I say that even though my own loyalty is to Kerry, which is, you know, the Yankees, if you like, of Gaelic football, the 37th All-Ireland this year, you remember, Miriam? And, see, there now, for instance, that was in a match against Mayo, wasn't it? No, it was Mayo, was the semi-final. That was against Donegal. And Donegal have been a wonderful team for the last 3 or 4 years, and so have Mayo been. I would have loved to have seen them, I might go so far as to say even against Kerry, but certainly against anybody except Kerry, winning the All-Ireland, because very fine teams came out, and you need to crown the sense of hope, expectation, anticipation, the excitement among the young people, and the teenagers and those who will go on to hopefully wear the jersey or at least be very strong supporters. You need victory somewhere along the line. And I would love to see more of the All-Ireland spread in both hurling and football beyond the core counties. And it's clear that, you know, you can, within, say, 4 or 5 years, you can bring up a county from obscurity almost into being an All-Ireland potentially winning combination. If you get the right training, and you get, obviously the players have to be there, but a lot of it is how well the trainer, the players are themselves organised and managed within the county. So a lot depends on a small number of individuals, because it requires a lot of talent to be an effective trainer of a Gaelic footballer or a hurling team. But it's latent there, because you can see the sudden surge among the young people in particular, as well as the quiet pride of an older generation, in a county coming from obscurity, coming from nowhere, to being among the contenders. And then it's very sad if, like Mayo, for instance, you've been very close, or indeed like Donegal, Donegal have one and all, you've been very close for, what, 4 or 5 years, contributed an enormous amount to the game, and then in the end have it snatched from you, even if it is by Kerry, right? So I think across the country, you see, more counties are involved in the football than in the hurling for practical purposes in terms of who are the possible winners in any given year. And I do think the GAA has a major job still to do in Ireland in getting hurling spread more widely and bringing more counties along in football as well. But having said all that, in comparative terms, if you think of the number of clubs which dominate sports over here or dominate, you know, soccer around the world, etc., the GAA actually is a relatively broadly based organisation in terms of the number of enthusiasts, the number of players, the number of volunteers, and it is amateur. I know there's money around, right? And there has to be money around for exceptional trainers and people like that. But it is truly extraordinary. It's very hard to think of many other countries in the world, certainly in the Western world, where you would be able to arouse that degree of sustained loyalty, commitment, pride, etc., from a local level. Now, America, of course, is the polar opposite in certain ways, because this is such a mobile society, and people are accustomed to travelling pretty well all the time. And because it's so mobile and the distances are so great, you go back now and again, but you don't go back in the regular way that you go from Dublin to Kerry or Dublin to Galway or whatnot during the holidays and things like that. So I think the Irish situation in that sense is unique, partly because we're small, but there are lots of small places around that don't have the same intensity of commitment to a national sport that the Irish have. And, you know, when you can put 85,000 people into Croke Park for an All-Ireland final in a country of, what, I suppose, 5 million, 6 million, something like that, how many other sports in the world can pull out a crowd of that size from a population of that size, representing, in fact, very geographically concentrated teams at the end of the day? I think it's a truly extraordinary achievement. So if we're looking back on what are the positives in Irish life over the last century, century and a half, or even what are positives in the diaspora, I think the GAA, for all the complaints that can be made and are being made and will be made about it, is utterly exceptional in global historical terms. Mm-hmm. It's phenomenal.
One of the things as well, Joe, that strikes me about the GAA and enthusiasts about it, yourself included, is how I notice with Irish immigrants who've been here a long time, sometimes ones who are very active or either active in the GAA in terms of participating in it here or will follow, you know, what's going on very closely in terms of the All-Irelands and the whole lead up to that. You know, it sees those people with a comparable degree of interest sometimes, not quite comparable, but people who are very interested in American sports or right. soccer and things like that. You follow, you like to watch the American football and things like that. You like to watch cricket,
right?
So, in posing that question, how does the GAA reflect particularly on Irish history and geography? I suppose you've touched on it a little bit. We are polar opposite to people in the United States or the populace here, because of nobility, internal mobility.
Sure.
We haven't had that history.
Sure.
Could you talk a little bit
about it? See, the GAA does come out of Irish history because it is founded essentially to counter the spread of English games. Because remember, it's not until the mid or latest 19th century that popular sport, all the great sports, I mean soccer, rugby, cricket in the English case, came to be anything like mass sports or potentially mass sports. And that was because essentially you begin to get urbanisation, you begin to get mobility. Imagine trying to run national sports before the railway, for instance. How do you travel around? How do you have national sports as such? And in this country, before the aeroplane, you know, because of the sheer distances to be travelled. So the sport, in the sense we think of it now, for the professional amateur, is a product largely of the later 19th century and into the 20th century, obviously. And in that case, there's a natural development there because mass audiences want to get out on a Saturday afternoon when you've got the length of the working week being reduced and things like that. In the Irish case, or probably in the case, although of many, something's just coming to my head, I'll say to you in a minute, of many colonised countries, the sport they adapted tended to be the sport imposed by the imperial power. And it was the imperial sport, but very often the native country, I mean the home country, developed it, obviously in the five colonies, if I put it like that, crudely, in Australia in particular, obviously New Zealand, to some extent South Africa, where cricket emerges as virtually their national games. or rugby in South African case as well, but cricket comes out in the 19th century. But then take a case of India, where cricket becomes a national game also gradually over time. And can I quote, this is becoming very, very, very academic in a way now, but let me just give you a little quotation. To show up the difference between what happens in the Irish case, where we develop our own games, and where we owe nothing, or very little, in terms of those games to the influence of the occupier or the imperial power. I was looking at two poems recently. I give you a few lines, a couple of which will be in the Irish language, by the way. One of them is a poem about a great, great Indian cricketer, Sachin Tendulkar, who has just retired recently. And if I can remember it, and I have a terrible memory, so maybe I won't, the stanza goes like this. It's very short. In cricket, the batsman walks the wicket alone. It's quite true. If anybody knows cricket, there's a 75-yard walk the wicket. The crowd is cheering you, etc., etc. You can be out first ball, and then you have a dead, silent walk back. It's terrible. But in cricket, the batsman walks the wicket alone. Not so Sachin Tendulkar. When Tendulkar walks the wicket, all India walks with him. In other words, he's the incarnation of an aspiration, of achievement, of triumph, of victory, etc. Now, the greatest Irish hurler was called Christy Ring.
A Cork man.
A Cork man, yes, I know, but you see, and if Kerry weren't as successful as we are at football, I might be grudging it, but let Cork have their hurling. Right? Christy Ring, a phenomenal hurler, but he died suddenly, relatively young. And Sean O'Tooma, who was a professor in UCC, you and I both knew him, Sean, and a fine poet and a lovely, lovely, lovely man, lovely scholar, Sean composed a ballad of Christy Ring. He had played with Christy Ring in Glen Rovers, by the way, and I just could take a couple of lines. It was in, he was referring to Ring having scored 3 goals against Limerick in the last few minutes of a Munster final, I think 54, if I remember rightly, where Limerick were leading and seemed to have it sewn up. The Rup Tree Hoolish Jock is Shandehe Ilignehiran Exturo Hamon. He lashed in 3 goals, which of course won the game for Cork. He lashed in 3 goals with all the ancient gods of Ireland guiding his hurley. So, in one line, O'Tooma sort of established a continuity between 2,000 or maybe 20,000 years ago, who knows, you know, gods are fairly flexible in that respect, but he established a continuity between the ancient sense of Gaeldom, I suppose, and the game of hurling. And hurling was played in ancient Ireland. It wasn't the hurling we know of today exactly, but in contrast to the Indian case, where the British had taken over, had in a sense drawn a veil over whatever was there in sporting terms in ancient India, so that in order to become a great sporting nation, you had to beat the conqueror, you had to beat the imperial power at their own game. In the Irish case, you had your own game already. So, or at least if you hadn't, you managed to persuade yourself you had. And so you were able to conjecture a continuity of an Irish personality, of an Irish game, that owed nothing to the imposition or the example of the conqueror. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a very important element in the mentality of the fight for freedom in the early 20th century. And the sense that, you know, they are destroying something, they being the British, and this is not an anti-British rant or anything like that, they are destroying something that is very precious to us, and once it's gone forever. Now, that was happening in the language in many respects, and there had to be a struggle there. It was easier in some respects to fight a struggle in sporting terms, provided you had the degree of commitment and leadership and intensity of local loyalties that the game that both football and hurling bring out. And that is a tremendous achievement of the GAA, which I don't think it ever received sufficient credit for. Because nowadays, one is concerned in a national newspaper, the national organisation, etc. The GAA was an organisation that grew from the roots up. And so you had to have, across Ireland, you had to have people committed to spending a lot of their spare time, or maybe more than their spare time, in actually building up at parish level the teams that would represent them, and the sense of pride they would inject into, inculcate into, members from the, you know, the people in that parish. And I think that is, when you look at Ireland, it's often said that we're locally minded, we're localistic, why can't we see beyond, you know, our noses, etc. I don't think we are in the wider sense, but I do think we have this base to build on, where there is a foundation that we know who we are, as Irish, obviously, but we know who we are as Irish, but we know who we are at our local level. And the GAA has played an enormous role, I think, in inculcating that. Now, they face huge problems when they came over here. And there's this wonderful book, wonderful encyclopedia, one might say, that has just come out this week, The History of the GAA in New York, edited by Fergus Hanna, which was launched up at the consulate last week. And everything you need to know there is there, in terms of data. And when you look at that, Miriam, think of the amount of activity that occurred to be included in a book of that scale, that size, that detail. The amount of stuff, the amount of work he had to do and his colleagues and his supporters had to do in assembling it, but the amount of stuff that was there to be assembled, which is all below the radar, as far as we in Ireland are concerned, quite frankly. Also, the other thing you've got to remember, You see, a lot depended on the ways of immigration coming over here. And immigration continued in 1930, basically, in this country. And then it stopped virtually dead, because with the Great Slump, hardly anybody comes in the 30s. I think one could say that at least 20,000 a year came in the 20s. Never more than 1,000 a year came in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Then there's the Second World War, mm-hmm. when nobody's coming. And after the war, of course, immigration to Britain has grown hugely. So you have no more best of times than, say, 5,000 a year coming after the war. And to me, the recrudescence of GAA, the GAA has to cope with this, because GAA is obviously very generational. You know, you pay for 10, 15 years maybe, and that's it. And so between 1930 and 1945, a whole generation had passed. And so after the war, you're having to build from the roots up again, but with very few young people they are now to build on. And I think that despite the setbacks and disappointments and so on, that the GAA, since the war, has actually in many ways confronted a more demanding challenge, and I think is increasingly rising impressively to it. It doesn't depend now as much on a few committed individuals who are giving their whole lives to it, right? It's not a John Kerry O'Donnell sort of field at this stage. I think it's a much more broadly based. And obviously, there's a lot still to go. There's a lot more to be done. There's a pile of alternative interests and activities and so on. Immigration has obviously declined in many ways, except for the illegals. But having said that, the game itself, I mean, Gaelic football and hurling, they're much more sophisticated games now than they were. They're brilliant games, by the way. And part of the attraction is that simply they are such wonderful games.
But that was, Joe, to go back to, that was the point I was making earlier about the Manhattan Gaels, in terms of seeing the evolution of something like that as it's reflective of a new type of immigrant, you know,
yes.
who, what's really encouraging for people who, you know, I admire from a different perspective, I think, because I'm a woman. I don't follow the nuts and bolts of the games as much as you, as I don't take as much pleasure as you would. But in terms of an ethnic organization, to see this new type of young immigrant who, you know, these people are connected professionally and socially,
yes.
in terms of communications and everything, they don't need the pragmatic
mm-hmm.
connections or the cultural
mm-hmm.
gathering that, say, Gaelic Park historically served
mm-hmm.
as, at least since it's been running. And prior to that, the coming togethers in various parts of New York City and in other places. And to see, you know, say, for example, the likes of the GAA in London really seeing huge numbers of participation again, unfortunately, because of the emigration, of people,
immigration,
yeah, from Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very, very important gauge of the migrant flows, to your point, historically and even in the present.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think also that the GAA, which is, you know, for all the times that you can get GAA decisions that appear to you to be less than wholly enlightened, because they have to take into account feelings around a lot of representatives from a lot of counties, a lot of perspectives, a lot of generations. I think to see the way the GAA is adapting to very rapid change, both within Ireland and globally. Because now you say, coming to New York, say when Kerry came to New York in 1927, John Joe Sheehy's team, that was an adventure, I won't say to another planet, but it was a major episode in their lives. Now people are back and forth much more frequently. And while one still loves coming, it's not something you mark in the calendar of your life as a very absolute unique moment. So I think that what has to keep the games going now is partly love of the games, obviously, because they are great games, but partly a pride in being Irish that transcends the games themselves, and that has a feeling of pride in being Irish. I don't mean, you know, an irrational pride, an unthinking pride, but that Ireland itself, for all the problems we have and for all the stupid things we've done from time to time, Ireland itself is one of the most successful countries in the modern world. We very rarely tell ourselves that. And I think one can have a legitimate pride in Irish achievement, tempered only by impatience and anger at times at how much greater still it could be if only we didn't do some of the stupid things we do. And football and hurling have been actually one of the sustained success stories of Ireland. We have been more successful. Those who run our games, those who participate, have a more sustained record of success than have our politicians, than have our political parties, even though they have a lot too. I mean, it's tempting and it's normal to condemn them and to say, look at the mess there, look at the mess there. And there are lots of messes around. You know that as well as I do. And a lot of them shouldn't be. But in comparative terms, which is all you can do in these things, in comparative terms, Ireland is by no means the worst governed, the worst politicized, the worst administered, the worst bloody well anything in the world. You know? On the contrary, in many cases, we're right up there at the top, but we don't blow our trumpets enough.
Well, you know, Joe, that for me is brought home often when I'm doing, as you know, the oral histories that I often busy my time with. And I'll talk to people who either left Ireland in the 40s and 50s, or sometimes the children of New Yorkers who were going to Ireland. And they describe, and this is not unfamiliar territory for you in terms of your experience in growing up in Ireland in the middle decades of the 20th century, they describe what we would now describe as a third world country in terms of what people, and it wasn't unique to Ireland in comparative terms, but to see, to your point, in terms of how much things have progressed on so many levels.
Absolutely.
It's remarkable.
You see, the 50s were a terrible decade in Ireland. When you look at, let's take economic growth rates. When you look at economic growth rates in comparative terms, Ireland is by no means a laggard in Western global terms between 1920 and 1940. Okay, there was a slump in the 1930s, and there was slump pretty well everywhere, and Ireland had a tough 30s, but in comparative terms, Ireland had a successful 30s. Now, I know that that's small consolation to those who had to become immigrants, or those who lived on tight rations in the 30s in many ways, but comparatively speaking, when you look at growth rates, when you look at employment levels and things like that, we didn't do at all badly. Where we fell back badly was, and for reasons partly beyond our control during the war, but during the war, the immediate post-war years and the 50s. In that 20-year period, we fell back to the early 1960s. We were way down any league table comparatively you wanted to look at in terms of world economic performance. Since then, we've had our ups and our downs, but we've had more ups and downs, and we've had higher ups than we've had lower downs. That isn't taken into account at all by a lot of the people who are saying what a mess we constantly make of things. We do make messes of things, but everybody else makes messes of things as well from time to time.
Well, one of the other things, Joe, that struck me recently, you've mentioned Fergus Hanna's book. It really is, as Joe described it, encyclopedic in terms of the range of digging and research that's been put together between the covers of this. How many pages is it? It's 550 pages and is jam-packed with information on the chronology of the GAA in New York over the last 100 years or so. But we, quite recently, and we had it on the program, we had an interview with Weishi Fogarty and Donie O'Sullivan. They were talking about this wonderful documentary that they were involved with Christy O'Riordan from Cathair Sibhín, again on the GAA in New York, and they did some interviews in Chicago and indeed at home in Ireland with people who've returned back from the United States. And what struck me about that event here, Joe, and the DVD, the clips of it they showed on the night and everything, and what I've done of the watching of that DVD, is what a fantastic lens it is on an immigrant community that transcends the scores at the end of a Sunday afternoon, right? It really gave some great insight.
Absolutely, and in fact, you've mentioned that was what I was trying to think of, which was in my mind 3 minutes before. A couple of things were wonderful about that for me. First of all, they gave us 30-odd hours of those interviews for our Archives of Irish America in Pope's Library, where, you know, yourself and Marion and Linda have got over 300 hours of interviewing in oral history, which is a fantastic accomplishment.
300 interviews, Joe.
300.
It's actually probably 600 or 700 or 800 hours of interviews.
Hours, I'm sorry.
But to add the 30 hours that these guys did, because they did a fantastic job.
Which nobody else could have done, because they had access to people, they knew who to go for, etc., across the country, not only New York. And there's more to come, I hope, and I understand. I have tremendous admiration for them. They did that without any monetary incentive, without anything like that at all, just out of pure love of, again, of capturing. But look at what they captured, because the interviews that they were doing there with GAA, former GAA players who were now domiciled in America, etc., and with active GAA players, what you have there is a sense of community, a sense of pride, a sense of achievement. There was no bail bucked about those people. I mean, there was no sense, oh, look at poor us, we're the poor Irish, etc., etc., on the contrary. And they were settling in here, or had settled in when they were an older generation. They'd settled in to a degree of achievement and a degree of contentment, which was wonderful to see. And I hope they do more back home, and I hope they give us some more of it as well, because I would love to have, you know, a centre for research in Gaelic games, maybe in Irish sport in general, but in Gaelic games certainly, here, where we have some capacity to offer assistance, etc., and where we understand what it was all about, which you won't necessarily get in, even in great centres which don't have the Irish connections. But that was what was on my mind. But I was also so impressed by the calibre of the people who were old GAA players who were responding to the queries, their self-confidence, their maturity. They had settled and settled successfully in this country. And many of them, you know, I hadn't heard their names for 40 years. So it was just great to see that what I'm sure is that a lot of that success can be put down to the self-confidence they acquired as GAA players in Ireland. Now, to be fair, they mostly played with successful teams, I have to say, right? But that's maybe taking too sceptical a view of things. I was really impressed by the calibre of these people as people.
What strikes me, Joe, as well, is that in comparative terms, you and I are both fans of the GAAs from slightly different perspectives. Mm-hmm. But in comparison...
My side keep winning. Sorry, Mary, I'm sorry.
My court father would have stuff to say about that. But I live by a park in Brooklyn, and I see these Ecuadorian immigrants out on a Saturday morning playing their games. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the really interesting thing in terms of a model that the GAA provides for studying an immigrant community mm-hmm. and the institutions that are important. And what's interesting and so rich about the GAA is the longevity of it, because it has been sustained over a period of time. We see it being reinvented, like the likes of the Manhattan Gaels or the teams that are sprouting up in the parts of the diaspora that weren't experiencing Irish immigration again until recently. So it's a very, for someone who thinks about those institutions and I suppose how we gauge how robust a community is at any given point in time.
Absolutely.
It really is a fairly unique example in terms of providing us with that kind of longevity over
time. It's absolutely extraordinary. And, I mean, from time to time, the GA has its own internal bust-ups and it does things that don't enhance its reputation. But overall, again, you know, that's, what, 1884 to, what is that, 130 years ago?
Mm.
When you think of generation after generation, the sustained achievement, the fact that you can fill Croke Park there on successive Sundays in September for hurling matches, football matches, etc., in a very small country. Mm. I think that's extraordinary. We take it for granted. The fact that we take it for granted, in a way, is the greatest compliment you can pay it. And we're talking now about Ireland, England, America, obviously. Think of the Irish-Australian connection. Now, I know there have been ups and downs in the sort of bringing the Australians to Ireland and us to Australia as well. But let that be developed. There are bound to be hiccups in initiating anything. It's where you are 30 years down the line from something that tells you whether it's been worth actually getting stuck in there and staying there and so on. So I think the future is very bright for the GAA if it can sustain the level of adaptability, the level of imagination, and the level of dedication. And let us not forget the dedication, because I know that, you know, there's a fair bit of money around there now, but the dedication has gone into that organisation for all the rows. And the rows themselves are reflections to some extent of dedications. Okay. Conflicting dedications, but dedications. I think, you know, it's one of the most extraordinary organisations of any type, much less sporting organisations, and certainly amateur sporting organisations, in the entire world.
Well, listen, Joe, on that upbeat note, I leave it. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Pleasure, Miriam, as you know.
It's nice to mark this special year for the GAA.
Agus níl focal gaeilge rátaga ná húsdra.
I know. Lán agus gurb, hílam agus nulli conadhe.
Agus bitse, Miriam. Gram agus.
The Wren Boy by Brendan Kennelly. The little eagle conquering wren has died for him, tautly posed on the threshold there. Gaunt in his Fomorian pride, white feathers in his hair, swaddled in gold and green, his right fist flicks the swarthy stick and beats the goatskin tambourine. The majesty of Stephen's day is on his face, grown proud as Lucifer as he begins to play. Lithe bodies stir to his music, cries of praise unfold, and fierce pride leaps in his eyes. As the ancient drumbeat rings, from beaten skin he steps into the days of unremembered kings. Alone he tops this day of hectic moments in a flood of notes, their gay, swashbuckling passion crashing through his blood. Christmas townlands wait, Carrig, Lenamore, road and field, they undulate to every open door, village byre and frosty ways show farmer, towny, whining crone, grow generous with praise. He knows dominion now and leaves behind the heavy spade, the ponderous plough for glory in the mind and blood, a man whose pride in stick and drum commemorates the bird that died. This December Day by Brendan Kennelly. Here in this room, this December day, listening to the year die on the war fields and in the voices of children who laugh in the indecisive light of the throes that but rehearse their own. I take the mystery of giving in my hands and pass it on to you. I give thanks to the giver of images, the reticent God who goes about his work determined to hold on to nothing. Embarrassed at the prospect of possession, he distributes to the wind and lets them pitch and leap like boys, capering out of their skin. Pictures are thrown behind hedges, poems skitter backwards over cliffs. There is a loaf of bread on Derek's threshold, and we will never know who put it there. For such things, and bearing in mind the midnight hurt, the shot bride, the famine in the heart, the demented soldier, the terrified cities rising out of their own rubble, I give thanks. I listen to the sound of doors opening and closing in the street. They are like the heartbeats of this Creator who gives everything away. I do not understand such constant evacuation of the heart, such striving towards emptiness. Thinking, however, of the intrepid skeleton that fear definition, I grasp a little of the giving and hold it close as my own flesh. It is this little that I give you, and now I want to walk out and witness the shadow of some ungraspable sweetness passing over the measureless squalor of man like a child's hand over my own face, or the exodus of swallows across the land, and I know it does not matter that I do not understand. Out on the Road by Eamon Kelly. Only once did it ever happen that I was out of Ireland for Christmas. That time I was in America, and after playing on Broadway, we went out on the road on tour, spending a week at a time in each big city. The week before Christmas found us in Wilmington, Delaware. Christmas Eve fell on a Saturday that year, and we, the Irish section of the theatre company, were dumbfounded to hear that we would be working on Christmas Eve. And not alone that, but we would have to do two shows, one at 5 and one at 8. What is known in the trade as a back-to-back. We consoled ourselves that America wasn't Ireland, where Christmas Eve and Holy Week meant closed doors as far as the theatre was concerned. On arrival in Wilmington, some of us opted to stay in a motel on the outskirts of the city, and you couldn't ask for nicer weather as we drove into the theatre in the DuPont complex for the first show on Christmas Eve. We played to a full house, and a meal and a rest were in order of the day when the show was over, so that we didn't have time to venture out into the city to see what the weather was like before the curtain went up again at 8 o'clock. Like the first house, the second was also full, and I couldn't help wondering, remembering what Christmas Eve was like in my young days in Ireland, if the people had any homes to go to, or any decorations to put up for the festive season, but knowing Americans, I'd say all had been done already. As the play progressed, I found it hard to keep my thoughts from wandering back across the sea to Christmases long ago at home. The play we were in was Brian Friel's celebrated Philadelphia, Here I Come, and there was a scene at the opening of the third act where the family kneeled down to say the rosary on young Gar's last night at home before going to America. As the Our Fathers and the Hail Marys and the responses to same swelled and died in a sleep-inducing drone, the young emigrant's thoughts soared west over the Atlantic as he visualizes what life is going to be like for him in Philadelphia, far away. But on this Christmas Eve in Wilmington, as young Gar's thoughts soared west from Ireland, my thoughts were soaring too, but in the opposite direction, to our own house in Carrageen, Glenflesk. How clear it all became to me, every detail of the kitchen, the picture of the Holy Family, the berry holly, the laurel and the ivy decorating the walls, the motes on the chimney breast, the roaring fire, the Christmas candles in the windows, bringing what it was to us at that time a glorious blaze of light. Images of Christmas at home crowded the mind when we as children sat around the fire eating Christmas cake and hanging a stocking on the crane for Daddy Nanulog to put maybe a mouth organ, a jew's harp, a whistle, a new penny or a rosy apple into it. We'd know in the morning, and if Santa supplied the instruments, you'd hear music of a sort as we drove to early mass in a pony and trap. The sound of hooves on the frosty roads, the loud salutations at the chapel gate as neighbours exchanged Christmas greetings echoed and re-echoed in my head. "Your decade," from Madge, the housekeeper in the play, brought Gungar back from his dreams and brought me back to reality. The reality was S.B. O'Donnell's stage kitchen in Wilmington, Delaware. When we came back out of the theatre that night, the city was blanketed in snow and strangely quiet, as whatever little traffic there were seemed to glide soundlessly over the white streets. We had some trouble getting in a taxi. Those at the centre of the city didn't want to venture out to the outskirts in case they couldn't get back, for now the snow was coming down again and slanting in the rising wind. Eventually we were lucky enough to get an empty cab going in our direction. When we got out, the snow had piled so high against the walls of the motel, I had to brush it away to find the door handle, and when the door opened inwards, there was a wall of snow almost 3 feet high between me and my room. By scooping it outwards with my bare hands, a bit like a rabbit setting about making a burrow, I managed to get in without bringing in too much snow with me. Oh, I'll never forget the feeling of loneliness that came over me as I shut the door and looked around the bare motel room. Granted, the bed was comfortable and there was a dressing table, a wardrobe, a john and shower, but one picture would have brightened up the place. Just one picture with a sprig of berry holly behind it. Grin and bear it was the only thing. The night would soon pass, and tomorrow, Christmas Day, at the crack of dawn, we would be on the road again to Chicago, Illinois, 1,000 miles away, where we'd open on Stephen's Day. No rest for the wicked. I got into bed, thinking of the early morning run to the airport in the wake of the snow plows I had heard about. Then in the plane, in the wake of the flame-throwing gadgets which cleared the snow and ice from the runways, and then in the air, watching below me as the land changed from white to the brown winter terrain of the Midwest, where, according to the weather reports, there was no snow yet, but there would be some by morning. Just then the phone rang. A fellow player who couldn't sleep no more than myself had rounded up some American and Irish actors from the cast, and would I come down to the lobby? Would a dog bark? Parcels of good cheer meant for dear friends in Chicago were rifled, I'm afraid. Those of us with wives and families rang them up. Greetings on the line as Christmas Eve merged into Christmas Day. Toasts were drunk, songs were sung, and stories told of Christmases long ago, when the world was young and we were happy sitting by our own firesides.
I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the Irish and Irish-American Studies Master's Program at NYU. Ireland is an extraordinary object of study in the contemporary humanities and social sciences. It's a small country on a global scale, a small population with an incredible cultural impact. Our MA program is an interdisciplinary MA program and a transdisciplinary MA program. We're able to work with students who come to study Irish literature, to study Irish history, to study Irish music, to study Irish culture. All of them find a really dynamic home for their passions and their interests here at Glaxman Ireland House.
We approached the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies in a way that attempts to kind of break down disciplinary boundaries that sometimes impede the ability to really get a rounded understanding of a culture or of a history or of a society.
It incorporates almost every single part of Irish culture that you can get. It's not just Irish history. It's not just Irish literature or language or culture or music. It's a little bit of everything.
New York is actually an excellent place to pursue Irish studies. A steady stream of visitors is constantly arriving in New York from Ireland, and so we're able to capitalize on a really vital stream of Irish culture that continues to renew the presence of Irish cultural life in New York City. We're based in a landmark building on Washington Mews, which is a picturesque, quaint street at the very bottom of Fifth Avenue, right across the street from the Washington Square Arch. So we're in a very dynamic physical location, but we're also host to a dynamic internal energy.
The Irish experience is actually a key part of understanding the ethnic experience of New York City and the growth of the city and the development of the city into what it is today.
We're committed to the idea that a very large part of Irish historical experience has taken place outside of Ireland. We think we've actually fashioned a lens for the study of the Irish experience here in New York that really wouldn't be available anyplace else in the world.
The Glaston Ireland House is at the center of New York City, which is the center of Irish and Irish American studies, period.
This is where novelists, poets, essayists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists, this is where they want to come to launch their work in New York.
We have welcomed people like current President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, former President Mary Robinson, Bono.
Recently, Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney came and spoke very eloquently about how he sees the contribution of Ireland House into Irish cultural life. If James Joyce were alive and wanted to launch a new book in the United States, Glaxman Ireland House at NYU is where he would launch it.
NYU offers a summer in Dublin program whereby students travel and spend 6 weeks at Trinity College in Dublin, the oldest university in Ireland.
I studied abroad at Trinity through the NYU Glaxman Ireland House last summer. It really connects the experience that you have here studying, history or the language or literature to something concrete and real.
Dublin's a really interesting and enjoyable experience for students. It's right in the middle of summer. There's a lot going on in the city in terms of cultural events. So students actually live on campus and study, take their classes on campus in Trinity.
One of the things that sets our summer study abroad program apart is the extent to which we get our students outside of Dublin.
Every single place that you go to in Ireland, every county has a wildly different, culture or community than the county next door. We got to go see the west of Ireland. We went to Inishbofin, which is a tiny island about a 45-minute ferry ride off the coast of Galway. We went to Northern Ireland as well, which was really, really cool.
One of the most impressive places for me, I think, was Tory Island, because it is a very remote place that a lot of Irish people don't even go to and are very surprised when you tell them that you've been there. And we got to meet the king of Tory Island, who gave us a tour and was an incredibly interesting man. And it was just a really cool experience to have that, where most Irish people even would be surprised to hear that you've done this.
In addition to planned trips, students also have free time where we allow them to travel all over Ireland, and they've gone to extraordinary places on their own. Our students have really come away from that experience of studying in Ireland with an incredibly positive view of the country and of the program that's brought them there.
It is by far one of the best things I've ever done, and if I could go back and do it again, I'd do it every single summer.
The majority of our courses are offered between 6 and 9 in the evening here at Ireland House. And that enables people who are working full-time to pursue the degree by doing one or two courses a semester. It's a challenge to be a graduate student today. There's no doubt about that. We're now actually in a position to give financial support, up to 50% of financial aid, to students pursuing the program either full-time or part-time. And we're really excited about that, because we think people with a passion deserve that kind of support.
We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.